conclusions can be drawn from them, which bear a fatal resemblance to the lax conceptions of Werner Sombart and Ortega y Gasset. Mannheim speaks of a proletarianization of the intelligentsia. He is correct in calling attention to the fact that the cultural market is flooded. There are, he observes, more culturally qualified from the standpoint of formal education, that is, people available than there are suitable positions for them. This situation, however, is supposed to lead to a drop in the social value of culture, since it is a sociological law that the social value of cultural goods is a function of the social status of those who produce them. Page 457. At the same time, he continues, the social value of cultural necessarily declines because the recruiting of new members of the intelligentsia extends increasingly to lower social strata, especially that of the petty officialdom. Thus, the notion of the proletarian is formalized. It appears as a mere structure of consciousness, as with the upper bourgeoisie, which condemns anyone not familiar with the rules as a prolet. The genesis of this process is not considered and as a result is falsified. By calling attention to a structural assimilation of consciousness to that of the lowest strata of society, he implicitly shifts the blame to the members of those strata and their alleged emancipation in mass democracy. Yet, stultification is caused not by the oppressed but by oppression. And it affects not only the oppressed, but in their essentials, the oppressors as well, a fact to which Mannheim paid little attention. The flooding of intellectual vocations is due to the flooding of economic occupations as such, basically to technological unemployment. It has nothing to do with Mannheim's democratization of the elites, and the reserve army of intellectuals is the last to influence them. Moreover, the sociological law which makes the so-called status of cultural dependent on that of those who produce it as a textbook example of a false generalization. One need only recall the music of the 18th century, the cultural relevance of which in the Germany of the time stands beyond all doubt. Musicians, except for the maestri, prima donnas, and castrati, attached to the courts were held in low esteem. Bach lived as a subordinate church official and the young Haydn as a servant. Musicians attained social status only when their products were no longer suitable for immediate consumption, when the composer set himself against society as its own master. With Beethoven, the reason for Mannheim's false conclusion lies in the psychologism of his method. The individualistic facade of society concealed from him the fact that its essence consists precisely in developing forms which undergo a process of sedimentation and which reduce individuals to mere agents of objective tendencies. Its disillusioned mien notwithstanding, the standpoint of the sociology of knowledge is pre-Hegelian. Its recourse to a group of organizers, in the case of Mannheim's law, to the bearers of culture is based on the somewhat transcendental presupposition of a harmony between society and the individual. The absence of such harmony forms one of the most urgent objects of critical theory, which is a theory of human relations only to the extent that it is also a theory of the inhumanity to those relations. Page 458. The distortions of the sociology of knowledge arise from its method, which translates dialectical concepts into classificatory ones. Since in each case what is socially contradictory is absorbed into individual logical classes. Social classes as such disappear and the picture of the whole becomes harmonious. When, for instance, in the third section of the book, Mannheim distinguishes three levels of consciousness, change, discovery, invention, and planning, he is simply trying to interpret the dialectical scheme of epochs as that of the fluidly changing modes of behavior of socialized men in general, in which the determinant opposition disappear. It is, of course, clear that the line which divides inventive thinking, which is rationally striving to realize immediate goals, from planned thinking, it is not hard and a fast one. No one can say for certain at what degree of foresight and at what point in the widening radius of consciousness regulation the transition from inventive to planned thinking takes place. The notion of an unbroken transition from a liberal to a planned society has its correlative in the conception of that transition as one between distinct modes of thinking. Such a conception awakens the belief that the historical process is guided by an inherently univocal subject embodying the whole of society. The translation of dialectical into classification concepts abstract from the conditions of real social power, upon which alone those levels of thought depend. The novel contribution of the sociological view of the past and the present is that it sees history as an area open to experimentation in regulatory intervention, as though the possibility of such interventions always corresponds to the level of insight at that time. Such a leveling off of social struggles into modes of behavior which can be defined formally and which are made abstract in advance allows uplifting proclamation concerning the future. Yet another way remains open. It is that unified planning will come about through understanding, agreement, compromise. That is, that the state of mind will triumph in the key position of internal society, which hitherto has been possibly only within a given national group. Within those enclaves, peace was established by such methods. Through the idea of compromise, the very contradiction which were supposedly resolved through planning are retained. The abstract concepts of planning conceals that in advance and in itself a compromise between the laissez-faire principle which is preserved in it and the insight into its insufficiency. Dialectical concepts cannot be translated into the categories of formal sociology without the truth being impaired. Mannheim flirts with positivism to the extent that he believes himself able to rely on objectively given facts, which, however, in his rather lax manner, he described as unarticulated. Page 459. These unarticulated facts can then be put through the sociological thought machine and thus elevated to general concepts. But such classification according to ordering concepts would be adequate cognitive process only if the facts which are assumed to be immediately given could be abstracted from their concrete context as easily as it would appear to the naive first glance. It is not adequate, however, if social reality has prior to every theoretical ordering glance a highly articulated structure upon which the scientific subject and the data of this experience depend. As analysis advances, the initial facts cease to be descriptive. Self-contained data in sociology is all the less at liberty to classify them to suit its needs. That facts must undergo this correction as the theoretical understanding of social proceeds means not so much that new subject Subjective ordering schemes must be devised, as it would seem to naive experience, as that the data which are presumably given embody more than mere material to be processed conceptually, namely that they are molded by the social whole and thus structured in themselves. Idealism can be overcome only when the freedom to conceptualize through abstraction is sacrificed. The thesis of the primacy of being over consciousness include the methodological imperative to express the dynamic tendencies of reality in the formation and movement of concepts instead of forming and verifying concepts in accordance with the demand that they have pragmatic and expedient features. The sociology of knowledge has closed its eyes to its imperative. Its abstractions are arbitrary as long as they merely harmonize with an experience which proceeds by differentiating and correcting. Mannheim does not allow himself the logical conclusion that the unbiased registration of facts is a fiction. The social scientist's experience does not give him undifferentiated, chaotic material to be organized. Rather, the material of his experience is the social order, more emphatically a system than any ever conceived by philosophy. What decides whether this concept are right or wrong is neither their generality nor, on the other hand, their approximation to pure fact, but rather the adequacy with which they grasp the real law of movement of society and thereby render stubborn fact transparent. In a coordinate system defined by concepts like integration, elite, and articulation, those determining laws and everything that signifies for human life appears to be contingent or accidental mere sociological differentiations. For this reason, sociology, which generalizes and differentiates, seems like a mockery of reality. Page 460. It does not recoil before formulation like disregarding the concentration and centralization of capital. Such abstractions are not neutral. What a theory regards and what is disregards determines its quality. Were disregarding sufficient, one could, for instance, also analyze elites by observing such groups as the vegetarian or the followers of Mazatlan, and then refine this analysis conceptually until its manifest absurdity disappeared. But no corrective could compensate for the fact that the choice of basic categories are false, that the world is not organized according to these categories. All correctives notwithstanding, this falseness must shift the accents so fundamentally that reality would drop out of the concepts. The elites would be group of the Mazdasnan form, which happened to be characteristic in addition by the process of social power. When at one point Mannheim says that in the cultural sphere, properly also in the economic, there has never been an absolute liberalism, that alongside of the undirected working of the social forces, there has always existed, for instance, regulation in education. He is obviously trying to establish a differentiating corrective to the belief that the principle of laissez-faire, long ago exposed as ideology, ever prevailed in an unrestricted manner. But through the choice of an initial concept which is to be differentiated only afterwards, the crucial issue is distorted. The insight that even under liberalism, the principle of laissez-faire served only to mask economic control, and that accordingly the establishment of cultural goods was essentially determined by their conformity with the ruling social interests. The insight into a basic matter of ideology evaporates into mere finesse instead of directing itself to the concrete in the first place without hypostasizing indispensable general concepts. The method